That's about 50% of the kids that died of TB. And one thing I can tell you too is that the chief over there now, her mother had 12 siblings. She was the last one that lived out of that school. She's seen 12 of her brothers and sisters go in there, plus herself, but she came out. She said then the other ones never made it home.
The Indian residential school system in Canada was an extension and evolution of an older system of genocide that began as early as 1540 in eastern Canada and during the 1840s on the Pacific coast. Its foundational purpose was the deliberate and systematic eradication of all indigenous populations that would not leave their lands and resources, abolish their own cultures and languages, and become Christians. That purpose has never wavered, but has assumed different forms and strategies over the centuries, adapted to the times and regions in which it played out as European conquest moved westward across the continent. European Christianity and its colonial empires were the plague. Residential schools were a refinement of that contagion. By the time that residential schools were firmly established across Canada, around 1900, the plague itself had exterminated most Aboriginal people, in a genocide whose details are still largely unrecorded and perhaps forgotten.
Well, we can look at the evidence of genocide and yet our mind not register the fact that it's proof of what we're talking about. This book is used in the university curriculum about residential schools. It has been for almost 10 years. And here's a picture of children with active tuberculosis sores. You see the bandages around their head. And the inscription says they have active, like open tubercular sores, and they're sitting here alongside healthy children. That was the practice described by Dr. Peter Bryce when he said they were being deliberately exposed to diseases. They weren't being quarantined. When you have tuberculosis, you're quarantined. You don't sit with healthy children. This is proof. This is proof of intent to commit genocide, this picture right here. Yet it's in a mainstream text. People look at it, and still to this day, they say there's no proof that we're trying to kill Native people. Well, the proof is right there in that picture. In that practice, which was happening at every residential school across Canada, and it was documented by their own people.
How did the parents and the relatives allow this to happen? The natives?
Well,
did they do anything?
They weren't allowed to. One of the documents I found is a thing called the Application for Admission Form, and it's a document that every Native parent had to sign or they'd go to jail. And what it did was it actually surrendered guardianship rights to the principal of the residential school. So what this did is, you had to sign away the guardianship power of your own child to the clergyman who ran the residential school. And at that point, the principal of that school then became the legal guardian of the kids. So that explains why these things could happen, how it could happen, because they were the legal guardian. They could do whatever they wanted to these kids. I remember when I released this to the press in 1997, we were holding a press conference and two officials of the United Church snuck into my briefcase and stole these documents. We got that on film, actually. But they were very worried that this stuff was coming out, and because it proved, you know, that they were culpable and liable. And as a result, in 1998, the Supreme Court Justice Hogarth here in BC ruled that the United Church and the government were equally liable 50-50 for what happened in the residential schools.
I was angry at my mother for years till I met her. And then she told me she was forced to. It was in the Indian Act. The cops came there and they were going to take us, or she'd go to jail, be fined, or all three. And that's in the Indian Act too, it is. It's in the Indian Act.
The Indian Act of Canada is race-based legislation that legally separates Indigenous people into a separate and inferior class of citizenship under the control of one man, the Federal Minister of Indian Affairs. The Indian Act allows Aboriginal people to be expelled from their homes on reserve lands, arbitrarily jailed, subjected to involuntary medical treatment, and denied the right to elect their own leaders. Under the Indian Act, Native people are legal wards of the Canadian state in perpetuity, having the same status as children or the mentally incompetent. This racist legislation has remained essentially unchanged since it was first enacted in 1876. Its philosophy and regulations were drafted under the guidance of the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches through the Bagot Commission created by the Vatican in 1845. The government of Canada enacted the recommendations of this commission in 1857 when it passed the Gradual Civilization Act. This legislation forced Indigenous people to surrender their land and identity and denied them any future title to their land, which was now owned entirely by the Crown.
That's what genocide is when you look at its definition. It's two steps. The fellow who coined the term, Raphael Lemkin, who helped draft the UN Convention on Genocide, he had a simple definition of genocide. Phase one is you eliminate the original pattern of a particular targeted group. You wipe out their language, their culture, you take them off their land. And the second phase is imposing the pattern of the domineering group on them. And that's exactly what happened in Canada, like in any colonized area, but it happened primarily through the churches here.
This is the grave of Harry Gallaud, and for me, he's the epitome of the problem. You notice his grave has been desecrated. He was an Anglican missionary. He worked for the government as well as the Indian agent, and he also worked for the local timber company. He was like church, state, and company all rolled into one, and he was the man who brought in the local residential schools, who made sure that the children were all imprisoned in the school. He is single-handedly responsible for a lot of the misery around here in the native world. So I'm not surprised that somebody desecrated the grave. This cross is a symbol of all the suffering these people have gone through.
Before you entered the ministry, you did not buy in what the church was doing. What did you think the church was doing?
Back then?
Yes. Before you entered the ministry.
Well, I knew that it was mostly talk. I mean, even as a kid sitting there in the United Church, I knew that you could just tell things. Kids are very intuitive, right? And they knew that these people aren't living what they're claiming. I mean, they're not loving one another. Is anyone coming over to our house when we're struggling? My dad doesn't have his job anymore. We had to move down to a hotel in the downtown part of Vancouver. Were any of the church people coming over and helping us? No. Not even the minister. You know, we were the pariah family all of a sudden. So I knew it was bullshit. But that didn't take away from what I felt in here was the message of Jesus, which to me was revolutionary. It wasn't
so
just,
where did it go wrong, Kevin?
Well, you cut me off there. Wait.
Sorry.
It wasn't just that Jesus was a nice guy, right? You're the benign, kind of loving man. It was yeah, like the hippie, right? That's never how I saw him. I saw him as a revolutionary. He got murdered because he was challenging the powers on behalf of the people who didn't have any voice, on behalf of, you know, the outcasts. I mean, the woman who was going to get stoned to death, or the people who are on the outside all the time, you know, the guys who get shit on all the time, they finally had a champion. And he said, not only am I your champion, but God is too. God loves you more than the asshole is doing that to you. And that's a revolutionary thing to do. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was like to me a new world. And I saw the church perverting that message. I saw them taking the side of the wealthy and the powerful. And they do this all over the world. They crucify Christ again and again, just like they're crucifying the poor. And I said, that's got to stop. I mean, that lie has got to stop.
Well, it's like the early Roman Empire. They realized, look, we're not defeating these people. The more people we burn in the Colosseum and throw into the lions, the more people are being converted. They have a moral power here that's growing in the world. Our soldiers are becoming Christians and are saying, we don't want to fight anymore. You know, the whole empire was unraveling. So they were smart. They said, you can't destroy a movement like this. You can co-opt and pervert it. And that's exactly what they did. They opened the door. They said, come on in and sit down, guys. Take a seat in the empire. We'll turn you into something successful. You know, we'll give you power so you can convert people. We will give you the means to conquer in this world. You don't have to be persecuted anymore. And they accepted it. They turned their back on Christ. They shut the door on him. And they became the church. They became Christendom. And they got blood all over their hands as a result. But he's still outside the door there. And I was trying to open the door.
When a lot of the stories began to hit the press about, you know, when the lawsuits began against the churches and the government of being brought by residential school survivors, at that point, the church decided to, quote, delist me, which was to actually throw me right out altogether.